Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Tending to your cardiovascular health requires much more than simply lowering your cholesterol. Maintaining heart health requires a combination of diet and lifestyle choices, along with a smart regimen of supplementation. That's why I've created the Intelligent Medicine Heart Health Protocol, my personal supplement recommendations to reduce your heart risk. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com for details. And for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about anxiety and a breakthrough technique to help you overcome anxiety, phobias, panic attacks. The book is entitled Panic Free. It truly is novel because, I work with a lot of patients on the issue of panic. We usually work with behavioral techniques, traditional behavioral techniques. Sometimes I tell them to get cognitive behavioral therapy. We teach them breathing techniques. So we also sometimes use things like magnesium. We use theanine. We'll use things like CBD. That's something that has a calmative effect. But these are limited in their success for people with dyed-in-the-wool phobias, severe panic attacks. Tom, what are some of the other conditions besides fear of flying that are amenable to this?
Well, it's if you look at flying, first of all, the problem is that the person who panics believes that they're in a life-threatening situation they can't escape. But situations that really aren't life-threatening but could push into a panic attack where you can't escape, MRIs, bridges, tunnels, mm-hmm. High places, even interstate highways, because if you start to have a panic attack, you've got to go all the way to the next exit to get relief.
Mm-hmm. This would be a form of agoraphobia where people are afraid of traveling or going out in public.
Well, the key, I think, experientially is if a person starts to have a panic attack, they want relief right now. Mm-hmm. And if they've got to wait till the elevator door opens or the MRI machine lets them out or they get down from the high place, that's not quick enough. Even sitting in a movie theater, mm-hmm. if you're sitting in the middle of the row, some mm-hmm. people can't handle that. They need to be on the end, otherwise they can't go to the theater.
Well, I had that experience actually earlier today because I was in my garage and I was cleaning up. I closed the garage and I realized there was a bird inside. And the bird was like flapping around. And the bird was like really hysterical. It was like flapping around at the window. And all I had to do was open the window. But the bird couldn't sort of rationally get it that I was there to help it. It was terrified. And I guess it was just a matter of a few seconds before I managed to open the window and let the bird fly out. But I guess that's sort of an inbred escape impetus that people have when subjected to scary conditions.
Well, that's perfect because you see what happens when you get into that high arousal state. You can't think clearly enough. And if there's not an escape right in your face, you might not even be able to use it. I'm remembering as we're talking about this, years ago, I went with a girlfriend to Italy, and we went to Venice. Now, in Venice, overlooking St. Mark's Square, there's a basilica. You can go inside, up into the balcony inside the basilica. And then if you go out the back of the balcony, you're on this deck that's up maybe 50 feet in the air that overlooks mm-hmm. St. Mark's Square, looks over the harbor, the tower, the cathedrals. It's magnificent. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to take her out there. And we walked out there, and she said, "Get me out of here." And I thought, wait a minute, we are out. That's not what she meant. She meant get us out of out, get mm-hmm. us back into where we had come from. Mm-hmm. But the bird, she had just come out that door. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't she simply turn around and go out that door? Mm-hmm. Because in that state of overwhelm, she couldn't even go back in the door she just came out of. Mm-hmm. So, once again, in a high arousal situation where you believe you're in a life-threatening situation or something you can't tolerate and you can't escape it. So we talked about how oxytocin can keep you from getting into this high arousal state. But Stephen Porges has encapsulated the things we can do to activate the calming system, the face, voice, and touch of another person, a person who is non-judgmental, a person who's emotionally and physically safe to be with. So that's the other thing that we want to link to that can give us some calming. To link oxytocin, we've got to plan ahead of time. We've got to look at the things that could trigger us and set up links. With using the face, voice, and touch of a calming person, we can simply link to arousal itself. We can say, okay, for the next few days, every time I start to get revved up, I'm going to pretend that this person who I have this ideal kind of relationship with, they are completely accepting of me. They don't criticize me. They don't judge me. So when I get revved up, I'm going to imagine this person walks in the room, says hello to me, and comes over and gives me a hug. So if it's like most days, you'll have a chance to practice that several times. After a few days of practice, it'll just become built in so that every time you get revved up, you get revved down.
What if you don't have an antecedent of that? What if you've had bad parenting, untrustworthy relationships? Does it make it harder for someone to actually imagine trust and solace?
Yeah, and you know, that's something I hear a lot with my clients when they start looking for that person on their own. They tend to look for some person who's to them kind of a big deal. And I'd say, I think you're looking in the wrong direction. Often the times when you're thinking about a person who you're impressed with, it's a person who tends to be critical. What about somebody who you might not even think is special, someone who's just really ordinary, who just doesn't criticize people, just doesn't judge people?
It doesn't have to be like Brad Pitt or Johnny Depp or something like that.
No, it could just be a very ordinary person who just doesn't get into judging people. Because when you're with that person, they'll be sending you signals that you're safe with them physically and emotionally. And that's what we're looking for. Those signals activate the calming system.
And so some of these situations or some of these feelings sometimes catch people by surprise. How do you rehearse the calming reaction so that you don't lose control before you're able to invoke it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. For the next few days, as you notice you just got revved up, which may take a little bit of discipline, because normally we try to not notice.
So these are exercises. So you have to sort of exercise that muscle, that sort of neglected response.
Well, I think that this parasympathetic nervous system activation is something that a lot of us don't really get good mental software for, so that you can build this in by next few days, every time you feel revved up, every time you feel alarmed, bring in that person's face, that person's voice, that person's touch, so that you then are intentionally using that person to calm you when you get revved up. And after you've done it a few times, it'll just become automatic. So you've got the situation where you can let arousal itself trigger calming, and you can take this person's face, voice, and touch and link it to being in an MRI machine, being on a high place, being in an elevator, being in a movie theater, not on the end seat, whatever it is that restricts you that could cause panic to start.
I'm thinking that the basis for prayer and religion actually keys into this, because, you know, sometimes people visualize like an all-compassionate savior, you know, the image of Jesus Christ, for example. And I'm not trying to be overly religious, because I think that every religion has that image, the compassionate Buddha in Asian religions, that epitomizes this, you know, certain deities in the Hindu religion, and on it goes, that are a source of solace for people who may not achieve solace on the earthly plane. Are you following me on this?
Yeah, I'm thinking about that, and on one hand, I have seen people who go into spiritual practices for escape. And I don't know if they're getting the face, voice, and touch kind of. I don't know if their parasympathetic nervous system is being activated. I tend to think they're not getting activated. They're just escaping things.
It's an ethereal experience. It's not a very grounded experience, in other words. Yeah.
And then you've got the other possibility that you might have heard of people who go to be in the presence of a person who's a guru. And for some inexplicable reason, you feel peace. It may be that, as Stephen Porges has pointed out, the face, voice, and touch of a person who's non-judgmental is calming. It may be that these people who are gurus have that quality of non-judgmental acceptance, and it may be that it's picked up as you have a moment with this person.
Give us some examples in terms of specific cases of, people with a bridge phobia or people with a fear of heights. How might they step by step address that? I know that that's really the grist for the mill in your book, and you take people through a specific program. But is there a way to describe the process in a succinct way?
Yeah, sure. What you want to do is take whatever the experience is and break it down to as many steps as you can break it down into. The idea is you don't go to McDonald's and swallow a Big Mac whole. You bite it into little bits. So you want to take the experience and break it down so you don't overload the linking. And then you want to take, on one day, let's say, and link going into the MRI machine to the face of a lover, or being with your dog, or nursing your child. That's for the oxytocin. Then on another day, you would link going into the MRI machine to the face, voice, and touch of a person who's non-judgmental. You can imagine, first of all, that you're face-to-face with them. You're picking up safety signals from them unconsciously, because they are safe to be with emotionally and physically. And they're holding a picture by their face of the MRI machine. So the safety signals from their face are getting infused into the subject, MRI machine. Okay, what about their voice? You hold a corner of the picture. They hold a corner of the picture. You talk a little bit about it. Doesn't matter what you say. What matters, the quality of their voice. That's where the safety signals are, once again, getting infused into that subject, MRI machine. And then as you're having this conversation, you notice your friend just put their arm around your waist and is giving you a reassuring, affectionate hug. Face, voice, and touch.
And so you suffuse that experience with these positive feelings, which sort of change your apprehension about it. And this is addressed rehearsal. This is, you're not actually going into the actual activity. You're contemplating the activity at first and breaking it into components. Going to the radiology clinic, you know, parking in front, going into the waiting room, you know.
Yes, piece by piece, exactly like that. And the thing is, you want to do this several times over several days, because you want to build it into what we call unconscious procedural memory. People who do high-stress jobs, like emergency room people or firefighters, policemen, when they get in those situations, they get stressed many times. Too stressed to think clearly. So how do they perform? Before they go into those situations, they go through training. And in their training, they have step-by-step-by-step procedures for problem A, step-by-step procedure for problem B, and so on. So they rehearse this so that when they actually are in the situation, they rely on what's been built into their unconscious procedural memory, just to help listeners understand what we're talking about here. When you learn to drive your car, initially you had to pay a lot of attention to it. You really had to keep your mind on it. But as you did it, it got easier. And now, these days, you could drive the car and have a conversation with someone. So your unconscious procedural memory's got a huge amount of ability. By the way, it can do this job for you, but it can't make decisions. For example, if you're driving your car on unconscious procedural memory and having a conversation, you might drive right by your exit. But it will do the job as long as it's a cut and dried procedure. Mm-hmm. And we can train unconscious procedural memory to bring to mind face, voice, and touch when you go into the MRI machine. We can train it to remember a moment of some experience that produced oxytocin when you go into the MRI machine.
Hmm. That sounds great. How long does the process take, or does it depend on the degree of anxiety or the type of phobia?
Well, we just kind of went for 10 days because people who have anxiety really need to have something very clearly defined as this is the procedure I need to do.
I wanted to emphasize that it's not like an endless process like Freudian analysis, you know, years and years,
right.
You know, where the psychiatrist is racking up the bills and, you know, Tony Soprano was sitting there and pouring his heart out, and it ultimately didn't work out that well for Tony in the series.
But what I find with people who I work with on fear of flying, I will give them the assignment to do this practice. And if I don't tell them exactly how many times to do it, I'll hear from them a month later that they've done it 30 times and they wonder if they've done it enough. They only need to do it 2 or 3 times. So 10 days is plenty of time to have this work out.
So importantly, has this been validated? Because, you know, typically, you know, various techniques, mm-hmm. Drugs, you know, they go through testing and blah, blah, blah. What's the success rate using this technique?
Well, our lab was at 30,000 feet. What happened was with people going through the fear of flying program, they would have videotapes to learn this procedure as well as things about how flying works. But to learn this exercise, and I would do a counseling session with them to make sure they had it, that they were doing it properly. And then a couple of years ago, I sent out a questionnaire to see how well people were doing. And 80-some percent said that they had no more panic in the air at all.
Hmm. That's a good rate of success.
The thing that surprised me was that I also asked if you had panic on the ground before. And of the people who had panic on the ground before, also in the low 80s, however, not the high 80s, almost a little over 80% of them no longer had panic on the ground. And we hadn't even approached dealing with panic on the ground.
So this is there's a spreading effect. It's not just a discrete thing, you know, where you sign up for your flight phobia treatments and then, okay, next we'll tackle bridges and tunnels and next we'll, you know, it actually has a sort of a pervasive effect.
Well, it did, but then now, in order to really hone in on this, we have scripts in the book for these specific situations, elevators and bridges and tunnels and MRI machines and so on, high places, because it does work better if you link directly mm-hmm. to the challenge.
Mm-hmm. But it was individualized the treatment.
Yeah. But it was surprising that 80% who we hadn't even tried to approach panic on the ground, and they were getting panic free on the ground. Meanwhile, it turns out that about 17% of people who are treated with cognitive behavioral therapy become panic free.
Mm-hmm. Which is considered the first line treatment these days for anxiety and phobias. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I saw 17% versus 80%, I thought, whoa, what? I had thought that I had, you know, as you said, it's considered the gold standard. I had assumed it was doing the job, but I was surprised to see, although they say most people do improve, but only 17% get complete remission. I thought, well, gee, there's something we should do about that.
Tom, have you heard of virtual reality something that helps people with? I mean, you put on the virtual reality goggles and it simulates whatever experience you're having. What's your take on that?
Well, I got a take on that because the original research on virtual reality for fear of flying was done here in Connecticut, and I was involved. What happened was that they had people who went through the virtual reality program. And they had a control group that they put on a parked airplane for less than an hour.
Mm-hmm.
After the job was done, the two groups were compared. The people who sat on the parked airplane for less than an hour were just as good in terms of actual flying on a real airplane as the people who went through virtual reality.
Yeah. So
that tells you it tells you basically it's a failure.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of money behind it.
It's high tech, it's a gadget, right.
And so what comes next is they didn't accept the fact that it had failed, and they flat out misled the public and psychologists by saying that since virtual reality had the same performance as sitting on a parked airplane, they said virtual reality is a, quote, convenient alternative to a traditional fear of flying course. Now, here's the lie. Sitting
which,
on a parked
neither,
airplane
neither
is not
which
a traditional
really work. Thing. Yeah, neither of which really work. So it's a convenient alternative to something else that doesn't work.
Right? No, but the thing is, sitting on a parked airplane is not a traditional fear
right.
of flying course.
Exactly.
That's the point. A traditional fear of flying course is what Slim Cummings did at Pan Am. 3-day course, learning about how flying works.
Yep.
Parked airplane, yes, but a real airplane as well. And breathing exercises.
Okay, so what about people who say, look, I like your suggestions. I read the book. It sounds great. But I think what I want to make sure I'm really relaxed when I do this process. I'm going to take a couple of Valiums or an Ativan or, Xanax as I go through the process. Does that blunt the efficacy of the type of relaxation that you're talking about?
From what I know is really, like I say, our lab is at 30,000 feet. From what I know from fearful flyers, some people say, look, I just don't want to trust this on my first flight. I say, okay, go ahead and take, what you want to take. But on your next flight, cut it down a little bit, and over time you'll find out that you don't need it because this is going to give you more benefit than the meds.
Yeah, I will tell you, as a physician who flies on planes, I think one of the number one causes of people becoming really messed up and disoriented, like people who take off their clothes or who do crazy things on planes, is because they try to sedate themselves before going on the plane. They'll take a couple of Valiums, then they'll go to the bar, they'll throw back, a couple of shots, and it's a terrible combination, and it's not the answer, and it will, sometimes people are so looped that they completely lose control on planes and do crazy things.
Yeah, I remember that British actress who got arrested for that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
combining benzos with booze, and it's not exactly.
I've been called upon to restrain patients who've been on those types of combinations. They really get whacked out. So it's not the answer if you're experiencing flight phobia. Okay, so Tom, the reason I had you on here is I wanted to offer people a very exciting novel approach to this pervasive problem which, according to the statistics that you cite, is not really that well addressed by conventional forms of psychotherapy and deconditioning. So Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. You also have a website as well that introduces people to this approach. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the website is panicfree.net, and for flying, it's pretty easy, fearofflying.com. And I want to just throw in that if a person is interested, every Wednesday night we have an hour group phone session from 10 until 11 Eastern. And if a person wants to jump in and join to kick these ideas around that we're talking about today. If you go on to the fearofflying.com website and look under Talk and Read, you can find the chat. And that'll give you the information about how to join the chat and the phone session.
And by the way, very good reviews from people in the conventional psychology and psychiatry establishment. Here's one. Moving beyond traditional CBT approaches to panic and utilizing the latest in neuroscience, Tom Bunn offers a very creative solution to panic attacks. That's from a PhD researcher in the Department of Psychology at Smith College, and many other folks who are mainstream psychology researchers and professionals have endorsed this approach. So congratulations. I think you really are creating a paradigm shift in how we deal with these problems.
Thank you very much. I hope the word gets out and people can try it, and hope you have good results with it. I look forward to hearing how it works out for you.
Thank you so much. That's Tom Bunn, author of Panic Free. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.